Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take the material you give us, cut through the noise, and get right to those aha moments. Today, we're doing a really fascinating deep dive into the human musculoskeletal system, specifically looking at the torso, the spine, and the lower body.
Yeah, the sources you sent over, Anatomy of the Torso and Spine and the PAI ABC course, Muscles Manual Part 3, they're incredibly detailed.
Exactly. Packed with the kind of stuff a movement pro really needs, right?
Absolutely. So our mission today really is to unpack how our core and lower body are built. It's like elegant engineering.
Elegant engineering. I like that. Understanding how we, you know, stand up, move, generate power.
And also why things sometimes go wrong, why we get these imbalances. We'll look at everything from tiny ligaments to the big muscle groups.
Not just what they are, but why they matter for things like posture and stability.
Precisely. We'll even get into how our core works, kind of like a pressurized can, believe it or not. Simple idea, but super strong.
Okay. So if you've ever wondered what's actually holding you upright or how your leg muscles work together, well, you're in the right place.
You're definitely going to get a new perspective.
All right, let's get into this blueprint of human movement.
Let's do it.
So before we jump into, you know, the really complex stuff, the muscle actions, let's make sure we're all on the same page with the basics.
Good idea. A quick refresher on the building blocks. The sources start there, too.
Yeah. So what are we talking about? Like the basic vocabulary?
Exactly. Think of it like that. We need to cover the connective tissues first. So ligaments.
Right. Ligaments attach bone to bone, mostly. For stability.
Yeah, primarily bone to bone, keeping joints stable. Then you've got tendons.
Tendons are muscle to bone, transmitting the force for movement.
Correct. Tough, cord-like. And then fascia. Fascia's gotten a lot more attention lately, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's not just packing material anymore.
Not at all. It's this fibrous web that wraps around everything, individual muscles, groups of muscles, even nerves and blood vessels. It's intricate stuff.
And sometimes a tendon is flat and broad, right? What's that called again?
An aponeurosis. Yeah, you see those a lot in the torso.
Okay. And then we have joints, obviously, where bones meet.
Mm-hmm.
And bursae, those little sacs.
Mm-hmm. Bursae, small fluid-filled sacs that reduce friction. You find them where, like, a tendon glides over a bone. Really important for smooth movement.
It's amazing how these small things are so crucial.
Totally. And we should also quickly mention things like a fossa. That's like a shallow dent in a bone.
Often for a joint surface or where a muscle sits.
Exactly. And a tubercle, that's a little bump on the bone, usually where a muscle or ligament attaches.
Got it. So all this basic terminology helps us understand anatomical neutral. That starting position.
Precisely. Anatomical neutral. It's the universal reference point. You know, standing upright, palms forward, all movement descriptions start from there. It's our baseline.
Okay. Baseline established. Vocabulary refreshed. Now, how do muscles actually make movement happen? Let's talk origin, insertion, action.
Right. So the action is just what the muscle does, the movement it creates at a joint, it crosses. Could be moving something or just holding it steady, stabilizing.
And origin and insertion. How do those work?
Okay, so the origin is typically the anchor point, the part that stays relatively still. It's usually proximal, closer to the body's center.
And the insertion is the part that moves further out.
Yeah, the insertion is the moving attachment, usually distal, further from the midline. When the muscle contracts, the insertion usually pulls towards the origin.
Like the biceps example. Origin up near the shoulder.
Around the scapula, yeah.
Insertion on the forearm.
Right, on the radius.
And the action is flexing the elbow, pulling the forearm up.
Exactly. It's a classic example. It helps visualize that pulley system idea.
So knowing that basic principle, origin, insertion, how does that help us, say, when looking at someone's movement? What can we figure out?
Oh, it's fundamental. It helps predict the main job of a muscle, its primary action. But maybe more importantly, you can start figuring out its other roles.
Like secondary actions.
Yeah.
Or how it stabilizes.
Exactly. Or even how it might become dysfunctional if, say, the origin starts moving instead of the insertion. That knowledge helps design better exercises or figure out what needs releasing.
Makes sense. So muscles don't just work alone, right? They have different roles.
Definitely not alone. It's a team effort. You've got different players.
Okay. So first up are the agonists, the prime movers.
Right. Agonists or prime movers, they're the main muscle doing the job, like the deltoid when you lift your arm out to the side. That's the prime mover for abduction.
Okay. Then you mentioned synergists, helpers.
Yeah. Synergists assist the agonists. They might help with the same movement, or maybe they stabilize a nearby joint so the agonist can work efficiently.
Can you give an example?
Sure. For shoulder flexion, lifting your arm forward, the pec major is a prime mover, but the anterior deltoid, the corpus brachialis, even the biceps can jump in as synergists to help out.
Okay, so they coordinate the movement.
Right. Ensure it's smooth. Then you have the flip side.
Antagonists, the ones that oppose the action.
Exactly. They usually relax to let the agonist work, but they also act like brakes for control.
Like if your lats are tight, they can stop you reaching overhead properly because they oppose that shoulder flexion.
Precisely. That's a perfect example of an antagonist limiting range of motion.
And one more rule.
Yeah.
Stabilizers. You said they're often overlooked.
Hugely overlooked, but critical. Stabilizers work to keep a joint or body part steady against movement.
Like the gluteus medius keeping your pelvis level when you walk.
Perfect example. Without good stabilizers like the glute medius, the big mover muscles have to try and do both jobs, which is inefficient and can lead to problems.
So mobilizers create movement, stabilizers prevent unwanted movement.
Got it.
You got it. That distinction is key.
Okay, let's dive into the core, literally, torso and spine muscles. And we start with something basic, breathing, the diaphragm.
Yeah, the diaphragm, primary breathing muscle. And here's the key thing professionals need to grasp. It contracts by moving down.
Down, not out. Down, like a piston. That increases the space in your chest cavity, pulling air in. Then it relaxes and moves up for exhalation. That downward pull is also crucial for creating intra-abdominal pressure.
Pressure for core stability. We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
What about the intercostals between the ribs? There was a memory trick.
Yep, a good one. Internal exhalation, ribs down, and I in.
External inhalation, ribs up, and OT.
Exactly. Helps keep track of which ones do what for expanding and contracting the rib cage.
Okay, going deeper now. The spine's own stabilizers. The really deep ones.
Right. Now we're getting into the intrinsic stabilizers, the multifidus and the rotators. They're part of that deep transversospinalis group.
So these aren't the big back muscles we see.
No, these are deep, running along the vertebrae. Think of them as the spine's fine tuners. The multifidus is bigger, crosses more segments, kind of like a sheath supporting the spine.
And they rotate the spine a bit, but that's not their main job.
They do cause a little rotation to the opposite side, technically, but their much bigger role is stabilizing against unwanted rotation and shear forces. They provide stability segment by segment.
So keeping things steady is their main gig.
Okay.
Okay. Abdominal layers, four of them, from deep to superficial. Let's start deep.
Deepest layer, transversus abdominis, the TVA. Its fibers run horizontally like a corset or a weightlifting belt.
Okay, like a corset, so it pulls everything in.
Exactly. Compresses the abdominal contents, which increases that intra-abdominal pressure we mentioned. And here's the crucial bit. It's purely a stabilizer. It doesn't create big movements like bending or twisting.
That's a huge point for training, isn't it? We're engaging it for stability, not trying to make it crunch.
Precisely. Then, moving more superficial, we hit the obliques.
Internal and external. And their fiber direction tells the story.
Totally. Internal obliques run diagonally up and in. They rotate the trunk to the same side.
Okay, internal, same side rotation.
Right. External obliques run diagonally down, and it think hands in your front pockets. They rotate the trunk to the opposite side.
External, opposite side rotation. Got it. And if both sides work together.
Then they help flex the spine, bend you forward, along with contributing to that core pressure. Understanding their opposing rotation is key for training rotational power and stability.
And the most superficial layer, the six-pack muscle.
That's the rectus abdominis. Vertical fibers. Its main job is flexing the spine, the crunching motion. But it also helps stabilize the front.
Okay, that covers the front and sides. What about the back? The big muscles.
The erector spinae group. These are your main spine extensors, running up along the spine. They keep you upright against gravity, extend you backwards, and also help with side bending and a bit of rotation. Major stabilizers, too.
And the QL, quadratus lumborum.
Ah, the QL. It's deep in the low back, connects the bottom rib and spine to the top of the pelvis. It extends the spine, laterally flexes it, bends you sideways.
But it does something else interesting, too, right?
Yeah.
Depending on what's stable.
Yes. If the rib cage is stable, the QL can actually hike the hip up on that side, pulls the pelvis up towards the ribs.
So if someone walks with a hip hike,
yeah,
the QL could be involved.
It's definitely a prime suspect. A tight or overactive QL on one side can cause that. Understanding that action helps figure out if it's the QL causing a pelvic tilt or gait issue.
Makes sense. Okay, now, the big one, often linked to back pain. The iliopsoas, especially the psoas major.
Yes, the psoas. It's unique. It's the only muscle that connects your spine, your trunk, directly to your leg.
Attaches way up on the lumbar spine, T12 down to L5.
Exactly. And then crosses the front of the hip to attach to the femur, the thigh bone.
So it flexes the hip, lifts the knee.
Yes, powerful hip flexor. But here's the crucial part, especially regarding back pain. It also pulls the lumbar spine forward into extension or increased lordosis.
Ah, so if it gets tight, say from sitting too much.
Exactly. A tight psoas pulls that lumbar spine into more of an arch, potentially compressing the joints back there. That's a very common contributor to low back pain.
That connection sitting, tight psoas, lumbar extension, that's huge. I heard the psoas and the erector spinae called the pillars of the spine.
It's a great analogy.
Yeah.
The erectors support the spine from the back, pulling it into extension. The psoas supports it from the front, also influencing that lumbar curve. They're like opposing guy wires, keeping the mast upright.
Wow. Okay, so all this brings us to the idea of the core as a whole system, not just abs.
Right. The sources use that canister analogy, which is really helpful.
Can you break down the canister, top, bottom, sides, back?
Sure. Think of the diaphragm as a lid on top, pressing down.
Okay.
The pelvic floor muscles are the base, supporting from below.
Right.
The transversus abdominis, that deep corset muscle, wraps around the front and sides like the walls of the can.
The corset walls.
And the multifidus, those deep spinal stabilizers, forms the back wall.
So when they all work together,
they create and manage intra-abdominal pressure. It's like an internal airbag or hydraulic lift that stiffens the whole torso, making it incredibly stable for lifting, twisting, any movement, really.
So it's that unified pressure system that gives the core its real strength.
Amazing. And speaking of tissues holding things together, the thoracolumbar fascia.
Oh, yeah, the TLF. That big diamond-shaped sheet of connective tissue in the low back, super important. Lots of muscles attach into it, lats, glutes, obliques, TVA.
And our understanding of fascia has really changed, hasn't it?
Massively. Like you said, it used to be seen as just packing material. Anatomists would literally scrape it away to see the muscles.
And now we know.
Now we know it's loaded with nerve endings. It provides structure. It transmits forces between muscles, almost like an elastic communication network. It's dynamic, not passive.
Far from just packing material. Okay, that core picture is much clearer. Let's move down now into the lower body. Hip, thigh, leg, power and stability zone.
Absolutely. The hip joint, like the shoulder, is a ball and socket.
But much more stable, right? Less mobile.
Exactly. Deeper sockets, stronger ligaments. It has to be. The hips and legs generate massive force to move us, but they also have to absorb huge impact forces from the ground reaction forces. And they provide the stable base for everything the upper body does.
Precisely. They're the foundation.
Okay. Let's start with some hip muscles. Those deep lateral rotators, particularly the piriformis.
Yeah.
Why does that one get so much attention?
The piriformis is the biggest of that deep group. And it's fascinating because its main job changes depending on how much the hip is flexed.
Changes its job. How?
Yeah. So when your hip is neutral or only flexed a bit, say up to maybe 60 or 90 degrees, it's a lateral rotator. It turns your leg outwards.
Okay. Standard action.
If you flex your hip past 90 degrees, like pulling your knee towards your chest, the piriformis actually switches and becomes an internal rotator. It helps turn your leg inwards.
Whoa. That's wild. Why is that so important for us to know?
Well, think about stretching. If you're trying to stretch a tight piriformis, the stretch you use needs to account for that change in action based on hip angle. Doing the wrong stretch might not hit it effectively or worse. Plus, the sciatic nerve often runs right under or sometimes even through the piriformis.
Leading to sciatic-like pain if the muscle is tight or spasming.
Exactly. So understanding its quirky mechanics is crucial.
That is a definite aha moment. Okay, moving on. Hip flexors and adductors. Psoas again. Obviously.
Psoas is a key hip flexor, yes, and also helps stabilize the front of the hip joint. Then you have the adductor group on the inner thigh.
Pectineus is the most superficial one.
Yep. And the adductor magnus is the biggest and deepest. And here's another cool one. The back part of adductor magnus actually helps extend the hip.
Extend. An adductor that extends.
Yeah. Which is why it sometimes gets called the fourth hamstring.
The fourth hamstring. I love that. Okay. Speaking of the actual hamstrings and the glutes.
Mm-hmm.
Powerhouses for hip extension and abduction.
Right. Gluteus maximus, biggest muscle in the body, most powerful hip extensor. Think sprinting, jumping, climbing stairs.
Glute max for power. What about glute medius?
Glute medius on the side of the hip is crucial for stabilizing the pelvis when you're on one leg, like in walking or running. It abducts the hip, but also helps with flexion and medial rotation. Weakness here is really common.
Leads to that hip drop when walking, the trend Lannenberg sign.
Exactly. And then deep to those is the gluteus minimus, which basically assists the glute medius in abduction and medial rotation, providing fine control.
Okay, makes sense. Now, the sources talk about two joint muscles acting on both the hip and knee. Why is that category important?
Because their function and how tight or weak they feel depends on the position of both joints they cross. They can become actively insufficient, can't shorten enough, or passively insufficient, can't lengthen enough.
Okay, so which muscles fall into this category?
Key examples. Rectus femoris, that's one of your quads. Tensor fascia latae, the TFL on the side of the hip.
Often gets tight and blamed for things.
Very often, yeah. Oh. Then sartorius, the longest muscle, runs across the front of the thigh. The Taylor's muscle.
Wow.
And gracilis on the inner thigh.
And the hamstrings, of course.
The hamstrings are the classic example. Semitendinosus, semimembranosus, and biceps femoris.
All three extend the hip and flex the knee.
Correct. Except the short head of the biceps femoris only crosses the knee. But the main group, yeah, hip extension, knee flexion.
And the biceps femoris is the only one on the outside attaching to the fibula.
Right. The other two attach to the tibia on the inside. And here's another interesting point. Those two medial hamstrings, the sartorius and the gracilis, all come together to attach at one spot on the tibia.
The pes anserinus, the goose's foot.
That's the one. That shared tendon site has big implications for knee stability and certain types of knee pain, like pes anserine bursitis.
Fascinating convergence. Okay, moving down to the knee itself. Extensors. The quadriceps.
Yep, the four quads on the front of the thigh. Rectus femoris, the two joint one we mentioned. Vastus lateralis on the outside. Vastus medialis on the inside. And vastus intermedius underneath the rectus femoris. Their main job is straightening the knee.
And the vastus medialis has that part often called the VMO, the oblique fibers. There's some debate about training that specifically.
Yeah, the VMO, those teardrop fibers near the kneecap. For years, the thinking was you could isolate and strengthen it to help knee tracking. The sources suggest, and current thinking generally agrees, that it's really hard, maybe impossible, to selectively strengthen just the VMO.
So strengthening the whole quad group is usually the better approach?
Generally, yes. Though ensuring full knee extension in exercises does seem to emphasize the VMO's role, but the idea of isolating it is debatable.
Good clarification. Yeah. Knee flexors. Hamstrings again.
Hamstrings are primary knee flexors, but also the popliteus muscle.
The gluteus. Small one behind the knee.
Yeah, small but important. Its main job is to unlock the knee when it's fully extended. It gives a little internal rotation twist to the tibia to initiate flexion. It's also a key stabilizer for the back of the knee.
The unlocker. Oh. Okay, down to the calf now. Gastrocnemius.
Gastrocnemius, or gastroc, that's the bulky two-headed muscle you see. It crosses the knee and the ankle, so it helps flex the knee, and plantar flexes the foot, points the toes down.
I'm underneath that.
The soleus. It's deeper and wider than the gastroc. It only crosses the ankle, so its only job is plantar flexion. But it's incredibly strong and important for posture and walking.
So gastroc does knee flexion and plantar flexion. Soleus just plantar flexion. That matters for stretching and strengthening, right?
Absolutely. To stretch the gastroc fully, you need the knees straight. To focus more on the soleus, you bend the knee slightly during a calf stretch. Same applies to strengthening exercises like calf raises.
And they're the ones that cramp up easily.
Oh, yeah, especially if you point your toes hard or for a long time. There's also a tiny muscle called plantaris in there, sometimes mistaken for a nerve, but it's pretty insignificant functionally.
Okay, last stop. The ankle and foot movements. Plantar flexion is pointing down using gastroc and soleus. What else helps?
Also, key plantar flexors, especially for controlling the arch, are tibialis posterior, flexor digitorum longus, curls the toes, and flexor hallucis longus, curls the big toe. They run behind the inner ankle bone.
Got it. And lifting the foot up, dorsiflexion.
Main player there is tibialis anterior on the front of your shin. That's the one that gets sore walking uphill a lot.
Shin splints territory.
Can be related, yeah. And then turning the sole of the foot outwards aversion. That's mainly the fibularis group, longus, brevis, and tertius on the outside of the lower leg, also called peroneal sometimes.
And turning the sole inwards inversion.
Primarily tibialis anterior and tibialis posterior working together. That balance between the everters and inverters is crucial for ankle stability.
Okay, wow. We've covered a ton of individual muscles.
Mm-hmm.
But the sources also zoom out, right? Looking at bigger picture things, like muscle shapes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The shape of a muscle tells you a lot about its job. There are about five main types.
Five shapes. Okay, what are they?
You've got circular, like sphincters around openings, think lips. Convergent, where the muscle starts wide and narrows to a single tendon, like your pec major. Great for generating force on one point.
Convergent for force.
Oh, then. Parallel, where the fibers run alongside each other, like sartorius. These are usually long muscles, built for large range of motion, maybe less force.
Parallel for range. Makes sense.
Fusiform is a type of parallel, but it's spindle-shaped, thicker in the middle, like the biceps, efficient for movement. And finally, pinnate.
Pinnate, like a feather.
Exactly. The fibers attach obliquely, like barbs on a feather, to a central tendon. Think rectus femoris. These muscles can pack in a lot of fiber, so they're incredibly strong, built for high force production, even if the actual contraction distance is shorter.
That's really cool. So shape dictates function force versus range of motion. How does knowing that help a movement pro?
It helps tailor exercise selection. If you need pure strength, target those pinnate or convergent muscles. If you need speed or range, focus on parallel fusiform ones. It avoids generic training.
Right, matching the exercise to the muscle's design. Now, another big picture idea. How do muscles actually grow? People think we get more muscle fibers.
That's a common misconception. The sources are clear. When we strength train, our muscles get bigger, mainly through hypertrophy.
Hypertrophy, meaning the individual muscle fibers get bigger.
Exactly. Increase in the size of the existing fibers, not hyperplasia, which would be an increase in the number of fibers. While hyperplasia might happen in some very specific circumstances, for typical exercise-induced growth in humans, it's about making the fibers you have larger and stronger.
So not more cells, just bigger cells. Right. Why is that important to clarify for people?
It manages expectations. It emphasizes that getting stronger relies on stimulating those existing fibers to grow through things like progressive overload and proper recovery, not just wishing for more fibers to appear. Quality of training matters for growing those fibers.
Good point. And finally, the sources touch on mobility, the range of motion spectrum.
Yeah, just defining the terms. Hypermobility is having more range of motion than usual. Think dancers, gymnasts, sometimes called double jointed, although that's not quite accurate.
Verb opposite.
Hypomobility. Less range of motion than normal, super common with sedentary lifestyles where tissues can shorten and restrict movement. Both hyper and hypomobility present different challenges for training and injury prevention.
Wow. Okay, that was indeed a deep dive.
Yeah.
From the core as a canister, that shifting action of the piriformis, the new view on fascia, we really covered the engineering.
We really did. We looked at the building blocks, how muscles work together, the specific players in the torso, spine, and lower body, and even how their shape influences what they do. It highlights the body's complexity and resilience.
And how small details, like where a muscle starts and ends or its shape, have big impacts.
Absolutely. It's all interconnected.
So for everyone listening, whether you work with bodies or just live in one, what's the takeaway? Maybe next time you stand up or walk or breathe deeply.
Consider that symphony happening inside. All those muscles, tendons, fascia working together.
This knowledge isn't just academic, is it? It's a practical guide to understanding your own movement.
Definitely. It helps you understand why certain movements feel easy or hard, why aches might pop up, and how to potentially move better or help others do so.
So here's a final thought to leave you with, building on that mobility point.
Yeah, think about it. Based on what we discussed about hypermobility and hypomobility, where do you think you might fall on that spectrum, even just considering one or two joints?
And how might knowing that change how you approach stretching or strengthening or just moving through your day?
Mm-hmm.
What stood out most to you from this dive?
Good questions to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dives. We hope this gave you some fresh insights.
Yeah, lots to think about.
Until next time, keep learning, keep moving, and stay curious.